Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Now, you might be forgiven for thinking that back in Holy Catholic Ireland, no one had sex, or sex that wasn't within wedlock and for baby-making purposes, or that elsewhere there wasn't much sex before the 1960s. But that's far from the truth. Fern Riddle is the author of Sex, Lessons from History, and Fern joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon to you, Fern.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Apart from people always having had sex throughout history, there always seems to be periods where whoever's in charge tries to oppress that urge and indeed the practice. What's the reason for that?
I think one of the things that's kind of been fascinating in writing this book is learning just how much our systems of power, whether it's the state or the church or any religious organisation, has always tried to interfere and control their citizens' sex lives. And we see that time and time again throughout history. What's fascinating to me and why I wrote this book is to kind of look at the real reality of our sexual culture throughout history, which is what ordinary people were getting up to and how much they listened to church or state and how much they just got on with their own lives.
And the attempt to oppress it, it always struck me, actually generated more of it. Writing is more fun when you're not allowed to do it.
I think so, definitely. And it's more, I think it's more a case of realizing how much it takes a very small amount of people who are in power to put in laws that affect everyone and are unthinking in their approach to pleasure, to sex, to happiness, to joy. When actually, the moment we look at history, we know that throughout time, across the centuries, across eons, we know LGBTQA plus people exist. We know people have wanted to live in a different body to the one that they were born in. You know, these are not modern ideas like we think they are today. They actually have a very long heritage and history and have always been part of our culture.
Yeah, and actually on that point of gender fluidity, how far can it be traced? Does it go
back to the dawn of time?
Yeah.
I think, you know, this is one of the issues that we have with how we understand our history today. You know, history that we're taught in school is subjected to what our education secretary wants to be taught, what our state wants us to be taught. And a lot of people don't question the history that they learned about when they were 15, 16 years old. That's a very watered down version of the reality of history, because we've always thought our kids either can't handle the truth or need to be treated with kid gloves. When you're looking at the reality of history, historians as well have been utterly guided by the society that they've been writing in. So for the last 150 years, we've had quite a prudish, repressed sexual society in comparison to the people who've gone before us. So it's not surprising to me as a historian that today people like me and other historians like me are finding all of this kind of new information when it's not new at all. It's just no one's gone back to the archive to ask it these questions before.
Yeah, and I suppose so. And in so many situations in through the course of history, Queen Victoria didn't believe lesbians existed. The authorities that be don't know what to do about it. There is a case in the book of a woman born Mary Hamilton, but went by George or Charles. Was it 14 women?
Yes, she married.
Yeah.
14 wives. I think one of the things that I'm really passionate about as a historian is making clear that we can find so many different lives and types of life in our past. Because I think today these arguments that we see happening in our press and in our media surrounding trans rights and trans lives are incredibly derogatory, they're incredibly inflamed, and they ignore the reality of the fact that trans people have always existed. So one of the stories that I tell is not just the well-known one of Mary Hamilton and her 14 wives, but Charlie Wilson, who was born Catherine Coombs, ran away from an abusive husband, had always felt throughout her life that she'd been born in the wrong body, and lived as a man marrying two other women in England, and had an incredibly happy and supportive system. We know about her life his life as he lived it, because he went to the press and told his story. And he was a working man, he worked as a painter, he was a member of his painters' union, And when the press revealed that he had been born Catherine Coombs and had had this other life, instead of being rejected by the working men and the men of his union, he found himself completely supported. People sent him money. They found him work. They allowed him to live the life he wanted as he wanted. And this is kind of turn of the century, early 1920s, 1930s. So one of the things that I really believe today, when we're arguing about the rights of people to live the life that they choose and they want and they need to live, we don't have the right to say this has never happened before.
Yes.
Or it's new or it's different, because it isn't.
It's an interesting comparison, though, as well. Where does one draw the line and say now as opposed to before? But there's a lot of talk, as you've just been saying there, a lot of debate and a lot of controversy around the rights of trans people. Also, you know, a great need for people to identify what their sexuality is. And there's an increasing number of those, it seems, almost by the day. Yet at the same time, it seems like young people have less sex than people used to have.
Well, I don't know if they're having, I don't know if it's that they're having less sex or if they're just thinking about it more and trying to understand.
Gosh, we're all thinking about it.
I know, we're all thinking, I mean, who isn't thinking about it? But I think what young people are doing, I kind of gives me a lot of hope, is they've really grown attached to the understanding that their sexuality doesn't have to be defined by what someone tells them it should be. And that, I think, is really, really important, because all of our sexual cultures, I think, especially in the West, are really messed up. We have a really bad attitude to sex, whether you blame pornography, whether you want to blame lad culture, whether you want to blame women thinking that they have to be one thing and not the other. You know, there is a real issue, I feel, in our sexual culture today that ignores the lessons from history, which are consent is the most important thing, pleasure is the most important thing, and a personal connection is the most important thing. Mm. And if you look at any of the sex guides that were published really pre-1950, especially in the 19th century and the Victorian era, anything that dealt with sex was absolutely geared towards pleasure. And I think what our young people today are doing is actually reaching back into the past and connecting to those identities that wanted to understand what mattered to them, rather than being told, well, if you're a woman, you can only like men, or you can only like women, you can't like men and women. And the same for men as well. And I think that's actually incredibly important, because don't we all deserve the opportunity to love who we want
Indeed.
And find pleasure in our lives?
Before I let you go, the F word, where does it come
yes.
from?
This is the opening chapter of the book, which is called The First F Word. Yeah. And it was a real joy for me, because what the book does is challenge your perceptions about sexual history. So the chapter of the F word absolutely shows that the history of this was nothing to do with sex, and looks at the old slang languages and how we talked about sex when we didn't use the F word, and where it comes from and how it became what it means to us today. It uses Chaucer, it uses Middle English, it uses a long heritage of immigration and excitement and joy, and it shows to me, more than anything, that we've always found a way to talk about sex, even if we're using coded language or we're not saying things overtly. And I think our ancestors took a real joy in that.
Yeah, but it did actually come from this guy, I'm going to say his name, Simon Foucault-Butère, a butter churner from the 13th century.
Yeah, so that's the first example that we have of the F word being used in our language. It doesn't mean what we'd understand it today, meaning sexual. It means to hit or to strike. And at the same time, in Middle English, the word that we were using in place of the F word was swive, which also had a similar understanding. And really throughout the Chaucerian period, at the time when Simon was living, if you wanted to say the F word, you wouldn't say it, you would say swive. And
swive.
Kind of over a period, over a period of about 300 years, swive drops out of information and the F word comes into common use.
Fern, thank you so much for speaking with us today. It was a real pleasure. That's Fern Riddle there, the author of Sex, Lessons from History. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. We have to swithe off for a commercial break.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.